I guess when I got down there, it's kind of that, like, buena onda, like, I don't know how to say that in English, really, it's like that, you know, like, good vibes, like a person that goes down with all these good intentions, you know, and I think that was kind of me. Like, I went down and I just was, like, expecting to, you know, make whatever small difference that I could, and then I would walk away with this really great experience, and, you know, like, it was a lot, there were a lot of, like, personal pronouns involved there, you know, mm-hmm. like, it was a lot about me and what I was doing, and I think that, I don't know, I think that there's something in humanity that, like, we always kind of tell this one story, you know, so, like, I was going to go down and meet these people that I had kind of just blanketed, you know, like, as these really great Latin people that, you know, like, I was going to take part in their struggle and then be able to walk out of it, you know, but, like, I think that when I got down there, you discover that kind of second story, which allows for so much more intimacy and kind of this just wonderful, I don't know, more than anything, like, it's still personal because they filled me, but I felt like in those 2 years, like, man, I got dirty, like, we did the whole bit, and I think that you lose some of yourself, but you kind of fill it with that community, like, in that immersion process.
Bienvenidos al podcast Ghosty Horses con Brian Bieber, en que hablamos de cultura, de ser extranjero y mucho, mucho más.
Hey everybody, congratulations, you are listening to the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour. I am your host, Brian Bieber. I'm trying to think of some sort of catchphrase or slogan to throw at the top of. Catchphrase and slogan are pretty similar, but I'm trying to think of something I can throw up at the top of the show, and I'm just not... I waited till the last second, and I thought maybe something would just pop into my head, and it would be really good, but... didn't happen. So maybe next time. Look forward to that. Or not. I'm not gonna spend a lot of time talking up top because there's a lot of show this month, and this episode is very expatriotic. I don't know if that's a word. I don't know what you call it, but it's talked to a lot of people who talked about living in other countries. So that's a thing. I don't know if it's called expatriotic or not, but it should be. If it's not, right? Anyway, it's the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour. Stay tuned. Tanya Grogan moved to the United States from Rio de Janeiro in 1974. She came here as an exchange student, and initially one of her major concerns was she didn't want to live in some small farm town or anything like that. She wanted to live in a big U.S. city. So you can only imagine how excited she must have been when she got off a plane in Madison, South Dakota in mid-January, wearing the same sandals that she was wearing in Rio when she left. Shortly after she arrived, though, she met her husband, and she's remained in South Dakota ever since, although now she does wear slightly more sensible shoes. Tanya now teaches English as a second language to middle school students. Most of them are refugees, so their journey to the States was generally not as voluntary as hers was.
The students that I work with, I have a variety of students from different countries, from mainly from Africa, from the African countries, so most of them are in the refugee status. And basically what I do, I teach language arts as a second language to them, English as a second language. And one of the things that I do as well is that teaching kids from another country, you're more than just a teacher. you feel like you're almost like a mother sometimes. Mm. There are so many things that they don't know, they need to know, and you need sometimes to just stop and teach them about something that they had absolutely no clue about within a classroom. So when they come to me, I have sixth, seventh, and eighth graders, and I teach also a program that is called System 44. It's kind of a phonics program to acclimate them to the language a little bit quicker. We have a way of teaching that we have to have lots of visuals, lots of action. I mean, if a student does not know what hopping across the room is, I have to show them. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a sense of humor. You have to be able to accept that they come from backgrounds that are so different from many people here, and including myself, that sometimes there are certain things that are important to me but not necessarily important to them. Something that we assume sometimes that they should know but they really don't. For example, when they come from Sudan or from any other countries in Africa, some of them come from backgrounds of not having electricity. So they get here and they acclimate it to the American life. And a lot of times we assume that every other world is the same as here, but mm-hmm. every other part of the world is the same as here, but it really isn't. Mm-hmm. So we need to take that into consideration, that we are not just teaching the language, but we're teaching about culture. Okay. And also, one of the things that I like to do is encourage them to, first of all, continue to speak their language. Contrary to many people think that once you live in this country, this is what you should be doing, speaking English. The only thing that we need to really always keep in mind is that, first of all, English is not their first language. Their first language is where they come from. And in order for them to really learn the language, the English language, they need to master their own language, so they can make connections.
Sure.
You know, and that's one of the things that in my classroom that I really try to impress upon them, that continue to speak their language going home is a major component of them learning English.
That must be kind of a relief to hear that from their teacher if you're a
It is. I think it's kind of, it gives them that self-worth, that where they come from, it's okay.
Yeah.
I also encourage them that they should continue to celebrate their holidays, mm-hmm. to celebrate their culture, but also to remember that America has really embraced them mm-hmm. and is giving them an opportunity to be someone someday and be successful. But and I always tell them, and I said, my heart is half Brazilian, half American. I embrace both cultures, and it can be done. Mm-hmm. So I encourage them to do the same. The only thing that I always try to keep in mind when I'm teaching the students is that, you know, sometimes you make a choice to do something, which mine was a choice. And I always try to remind people that the students that we have, majority of the students that we have from another country in Sioux Falls, and the majority of the people that came from another country, they had no choice. Mm-hmm. So I wish that everybody would have not only the tolerance, but also the acceptance that they came here as a matter of life and death. And if given the right opportunity, if everything was okay back in the country, they would go back in a heartbeat. Mm. But they're very grateful for the opportunities. But life here, you know, sometimes we kind of assume that once you get here, because you have the American dream and you're going to have the opportunities, that everything should be really, really easy for them. But it's not. You know, they have the language barrier. The parents never learn the language. Because they have to right away get a job, so they're not exposed to that English language, and they don't go to school to learn. And so it's really hard for them to adjust, and I just hope that our community continues to embrace the people that come from other countries, because they did not have that choice to decide, oh, I'm just going to go there for, you know.
How do you feel this? Do you think Sioux Falls does a pretty good job of that now, or what is your take?
I think better than they used to.
Okay.
I still think that there are some people that do assume that, or at least expect that these people should be grateful and they should be immediately speaking the language. I mean, mm-hmm. it takes over 10 years to master a language. So it's an impossible thing to immediately be speaking the language.
And it seems to me that generally the people that are saying that someone should be speaking English immediately are the people who don't typically speak another language or have never really attempted it. Certainly,
I agree. And you know, this is a country that was built by immigrants, and but back then too, reading the history, there is also difficulty in accepting people coming from other countries and speaking any language other than English. But, you know, if people just keep in mind that the first language here was not English, you know. So, I think tolerance and acceptance and understanding that if they had another choice and go back to their country, if they could survive there, many would go back. But they are grateful to be here. But they, you know, it is interesting because some of my students have said to me, that they have less freedom here. And that kind of shocked me a little bit when I found out, and then I asked, and I said, what do you mean you have less freedom here? And they said, because we had more family time. Now my parents work all night. I don't get to see them. So there is that switch. They are trying to make a life here, but it is not easy for them. They have to take jobs all night long, and then they get home, they're exhausted. The kids are already in school, so they do not see each other. Many families don't even get to see each other in the morning. So they say, you know, the freedom comes with a price, and it does.
You know, when you hear people talk about the Peace Corps, sometimes you hear them say that they're joining up, or they're joining the Peace Corps, or they're signing up for the Peace Corps. But from what I've learned, those verbs do not adequately convey how complicated the enrollment process is. Heather Mangan applied to be a Peace Corps volunteer and found out that it's a months-long application process, and it involves all kinds of screenings and medical clearances, and it just goes on, and it moves very slowly because it's a government thing, and that old cliche that is true pretty much every time. But eventually she was accepted as a Peace Corps volunteer in the spring of 2010. She was invited to serve as a community youth and education volunteer in the Western African country of Niger. So almost immediately after she received her acceptance letter, Heather found herself in Niger, in a small village, living in a mud hut without electricity or plumbing. She was studying the local dialect Hausa, and was beginning her training with local teachers to start assisting them, and just sort of beginning to settle in to this new, incredibly different life. And then, just very abruptly, it was upended. Before she received her letter of acceptance from the Peace Corps, Heather, like most U.S. citizens probably, knew very little about Niger. And, knew nothing about the politics or its history. And then she got a really quick and ugly lesson in that almost immediately once she moved there.
In Niger, it actually didn't receive its independence until the early 60s from France. But it's a very weak government. And because of that, it's susceptible to corruption. Al-Qaeda has a branch that works in African Muslim countries called AQIM. And they have been having a presence in Niger. And in the last few years, Al-Qaeda would send out these threats, and they would name specific countries, and they would name Niger. What a lot of times they do, the AQIM does, is kidnap foreigners, Westerners, mostly for ransom. That being said, they don't really want to kidnap United States citizens because we don't pay ransom, whereas mm-hmm. the French does. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times they're looking for French people, but there's not very many white people in Niger. And so you don't know if someone's French or if they're German or American. They would just take white people, and they weren't looking for like Peace Corps volunteers. They were looking for like embassy employees, but they had this presence and we knew they were there.
Were you able to feel that presence while you were there?
No, I mean, and you have really idea who is part of AQIM or who isn't. And AQIM actually works mostly in the northern part of Niger. And actually, no U.S. citizen is allowed to go into the northern part of Niger because in addition to all of this, France pretty much steals uranium from Niger. That's the only real resource they have, and it powers 98% of France. And because we have such a weak government, they can get, I mean, it's France, you're not gonna mess with them. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of corruption in the north where these uranium mines are, and there's also a lot of landmines and things like that, and just really not a safe place to be. So we're not allowed to go there, and AQIM spends most of their time up in the north, actually. So you don't actually feel that at all. And I think it was November of 2009, Al-Qaeda did try to kidnap a U.S. embassy employee, but that person got away. I don't know how you get away from a kidnapping, but that happened. And then a few months later, they did successfully kidnap a French tourist. And then while I was there in the northern region, they kidnapped 5 mine workers. So it was something that we knew could happen. And because of that, Peace Corps had kept a short leash on us. Anytime we would travel somewhere, we had to text this phone. It was called the travel phone. And you have to text it. You'd say, I'm leaving this village for that village at this hour. And then you get there and you'd say, I arrived here at this hour. And then every Monday morning we'd have to check in. We had to ask permission to go even like down the road. We always had to ask, like they had to know where we were at all the time just because of these security concerns. And then in January, two Frenchmen were in a bar/restaurant in the capital city of Niamey. One of the men was actually going to marry a Nigerian woman the next day. And his friend was visiting for the wedding. And they were pulled out of the bar by Al-Qaeda and then taken to the northern part of the country and eventually killed. And this particular bar/restaurant was a few blocks from the Peace Corps hostel. I'd never been there, but it was a place Peace Corps volunteers frequented quite a bit. And because it was in the capital and because these two Frenchmen could have easily been Peace Corps volunteers, they were 26 years old, they could have easily been Peace Corps volunteers. It was enough for the government to say, no, we need to pull you out. And they decided that it was no longer safe. So they evacuated all 98 of us out of the country.
The typical span of service is 2 years, is that right?
27 months, yep.
And so how far into your service were you at this point?
6 months.
6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I just hit the 6 month mark.
So how was that? I mean, just mentally and emotionally preparing to, preparing for where you were at had to be difficult. And so at the 6 month point, how invested were you in this place?
Yeah.
And how, I mean, were you just starting to feel settled in, or how were you feeling at that point?
Well, the first 3 months at your village, so I'd done 3 at training and then my 3 in village, and those, they say, are the toughest months. So I remember that 6 month I was actually with some of my other volunteers, and we were like, yes, we made it. We made through the toughest 3 months, and we're going into our training to learn about projects. So I was getting so excited about all these things I wanted to do. I had a list. You know, I want to do this project, I want to do this for my village. And I got so very much invested into it already. And I was at the point where I knew that in 2 years it was going to be hard to say goodbye because I really started to love it. And I loved being there and I loved my people. And I was just really, really happy with my life. Like, I remember at the turn of, because this was just a couple weeks into 2011. And I remember at the turn of the year thinking, there's nowhere else on earth where I could be right now and be as happy as I am right here. And then to have all of that ripped away is just devastating. I say there are three parts of this evacuation that were really tough. The first part was obviously saying goodbye to Nigerians. The second part was trying to figure out what was going to happen next. And then the third part was saying goodbye to my Peace Corps friends, my Peace Corps family. And each one of those was just like a hit after a hit after a hit.
So what was the evacuation? I mean, when you say evacuated, what does that mean? What was that process like?
So at the time, I was actually, after 3 months of living in village, that's what they call your like integration months. That's where you work to become part of your village, become a community member. After that, you go to your in-service training, and that's where you learn, at this particular training, you learn about grant writing and doing projects. And then after the training, that's where Peace Corps volunteers usually really get started on their work and really doing big projects and things like that. So I was actually at my in-service training, which was in on the other side of the country around the capital. It was near the capital. At the training facility for Peace Corps is about 40 kilometers from the capital city. So I was actually there when this happened, and it was just like a regular day at training, and the training staff said they had to go into a meeting in Niamey with the country director, the Peace Corps country director, and the embassy. And that's when we all kind of got really nervous if the embassy was involved. Because usually the embassy doesn't pay much attention to us. We are U.S. citizens, but we're not. And we're there because of a governmental program, but we're really not. Like, we don't do the same kind of work that they do. So we just kind of stay away from each other. So they came back and said that the program was being suspended. And so what we had to do is we had to pack up all of our things. And they actually, the region that I lived in was a 14-hour bus ride away from the capital. They actually let us take the United Nations plane and flew us back to our regional capitals. And then a Peace Corps vehicle took me to my village where I packed up my things, and I had an hour to pack all of my stuff up and say goodbye and try. And we can't really explain at this point. We weren't allowed to explain why we were leaving, just that we were leaving. And we weren't supposed to tell them that we weren't coming back. And the idea was that once we were all out of country, then they would call our supervisors and they would call our villagers and say, they're not coming back, and here's why. So I packed up all my things, tried to say goodbye, and Nigerians in general just don't show a lot of emotion, but my host family could tell that something was wrong because they all started crying, and I took what little I could because we were only allowed to bring like 80 pounds back with or leave with us, so you had to leave most of your stuff behind. And then we got to Zinder, which was my regional capital. And then we went back to the Niamey, and I think this was a span of like 3 days. There's a lot of traveling and stuff. So in a span of like 3 or 4 days, we had gotten onto a plane and we flew to, Morocco.
So Heather and the other volunteers arrive in Morocco, where the Peace Corps organizers are putting on this kind of impromptu conference to discuss what will happen next and what their placement options will be. And while the enrollment process for the Peace Corps was complicated, it was nothing compared to the process at this conference. And so what were your options at that point?
So when we got to, they kind of told us before we were going to Morocco and all of this that we'd be given direct transfer options, the chance to go to a different country and continue or finish our service in a different country. And they made it seem like there'd be plenty of options for everyone. We had 98 volunteers, which is a good size amount of volunteers, but pretty small compared to like Morocco, who has like 168 volunteers. But anyway, so we had all thought that there would be options for us to direct transfer. When we got there, we realized that wasn't true. There were a few options for, it was different because of how long you had been there. There was a group of volunteers who'd been there a year and a half. There was my group who had been there 6 months, and there was another group who had been there 3 months. Mm. They had actually just moved into their village. They'd been in their villages for 8 days when we were evacuated. So the three options they gave us was we could direct transfer, but in order to direct transfer, you had to, they defined jobs that were exactly like what you had been doing in Niger. And then there was the re-enrollment option, which means that you would come home, fill out your paperwork, and start all over again. And then there was another one that was similar to that, but it was called expedite return to service, where you would come home for like a week or two, and then you would go back to country almost immediately. But you would start your service all over again. And with that one, you had applied for the position while you were in Morocco, and you would know before you went home where you were going to go back. With re-enrollment, you would apply, and then you would hear like 3-4 months later. Halfway through the conference, they finally said, here are your options. Here you have like a number. When you're initially invited to Peace Corps, you're assigned to like a number, and that's what your technical job is. And you can only apply to positions that were available that had your number on it. And I had three options. I could direct transfer to Cameroon, to Rwanda, or I could do an expedite return to service to Namibia. And I had realized that for me, I needed some time at home, just a little bit, even like a couple of weeks. I don't think direct transferring would have been a good option for me because I would still be trying to figure all of this out while trying to be in a new country and learn new things and things like that.
And all of this would involve essentially starting your training over, right? You would have that. Would you still have that 3 months that you would?
Not for direct transfer. I would have like a week or two of training, and then I'd be thrown in my village, and then I would probably be there for about the same time. So it would be different because with training groups, you go and you get to know the other people, the other volunteers. Here, you're just thrown into it, and you're just another person. And I just felt that that might be too hard for me, that I wouldn't be able to handle it. So I decided to apply for the expedite return to service option in Namibia. And, I just didn't think my options were very good. They said that they were going to only take like 3 or 4 people, and there was a ton of them that were applying. I didn't have my hopes set on it. And then that day, I found out that I was one of the lucky people to actually been chosen to go to Namibia. They told me, we're going to send you on a plane home tonight. You'll be there for 3 weeks, and then you're back off to Namibia. And it just worked out in my life. I was really excited about the job. It just seemed like the perfect solution. And then about 12 hours before I was supposed to get on my flight to go home, they told me I wasn't medically qualified for that particular country. Mm. And they said, the only country you're medically qualified to go to right now is Senegal. Because they try to keep all of us in Africa. But that would be a direct transfer. And we don't know if we have a spot for you. So you'd have to wait here in Morocco until we can find the country director and see if there's a spot for you. And I said, you know, I don't think that's a good idea for me, so I'll just go home right now. And so, yes, that was the end of it. And it was this terrible roller coaster. I mean, this happened within a span of a week. And it was just back and forth, and feeling just like you got beat up.
Do you know what your plan is now? What you're going to do going forward?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it quite a bit, but I really believe right now my heart isn't re-enrolling. Because, it took a lot for me to get there. And then I was there for 6 months, and it was this amazing experience. I'm not sure if I've ever been that happy. And then to have it ripped away, I just don't feel like I got what I wanted out of it. I don't feel I'm a return Peace Corps volunteer, but I feel like I don't deserve that. I don't feel like I had a real service. I can dream of
Kapardai moved to Honduras in 2008. She planned to spend the summer there volunteering with an organization called Oye Honduras, which is a leadership organization for at-risk youth. She ended up taking a professional position with Oye and stayed in Honduras for just over 2 years. So I sat down with Kat, and we talked a lot about the mission of Oye and what she did with Oye. And then as I was packing up, she said, and I forgot to mention of the military coup. So it turns out that Kat's arrival in Honduras pretty closely coincided with the coup that took place there in January of 2009. I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to explain the ins and outs of what was going on there politically. But Kat told this amazing story about something that happened to her and her friends in the midst of this coup. And I love this story because I like that it's a story of people being people in the middle of something really, really incredible and monumental. And it's just a bunch of friends being friends, and it's terrifying, but it's also just full of, it's a story that is told with such joy and affection.
The list of that my mom kept down. By her bed, I'm pretty sure. Because by the third or fourth event, she was pretty ready for me to come home. But yeah, like right when I got there, I think in September of 2008, and like right away in November, when I got up to El Progreso where I was living, there was like this huge flood, and like everyone, you know, all the poor people kind of congregate towards the river because that's, you know, it floods every year, so you can't live or grow anything there. But so then all of a sudden there's this major flooding, and we're making these baleadas and like all this food to like send down, and people are sleeping on them.
What was that word?
Baleadas?
Yeah.
It's the best food ever. It's like, it's just this ghetto little tortilla, and then you put just beans and eggs. Well, you can put anything on it. Beans, eggs, cheese, like this white cheese. I put avocados and like hot sauce on mine. But it's just street food. So anyway, okay. Like we like rolled out like a few hundred baleadas with all like the neighborhood women, and we're like feeding people who are living on the highway. So I think that was my first real like, whoa, this stuff's kind of for real moment.
Yeah,
yeah. So that's the flood is the first. And then a few months later, I think in May, there was a 7.3 earthquake, which was insane. Like, it took out the big bridge that came in, or one of the big bridges that came into town. It knocked out, like, the local grocery store, and it was the weirdest thing I'd ever... I'm from Minnesota, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we don't have earthquakes, so
yeah.
That was pretty trippy. So anyway, there was a flood, then the earthquake, and then a month later to the date of the earthquake, there was a military coup, which meant the president was ousted by the military, and we woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning to see the president of Honduras in his pajamas talking to the people from Costa Rica, you know. And so then we went into however many weeks of military and state and police enforced, like, curfews and rumors and, like, me walking around, like, you know, how many times are you going to experience a coup, right? So,
yeah.
So I, like, would throw on my flip-flops, and I would just kind of, like, go to... Because you could kind of stay away from it unless you went to the centers or unless it was curfew and then you were in trouble. But you would just kind of walk around, like, the center.
Well, what is... When you say experience a coup, like, what is... As a coup's happening, what does it look like?
Yeah, it's visually
I think
pretty
about it
interesting.
As something...
Yeah.
I think of the end of the coup being the president in his pajamas in Costa Rica.
Well, that's the beginning of our coup.
Okay.
Yeah, it was him in his pajamas. But I actually flew in the day after the coup happened. I was in Alaska at the time. And, like, so all
what?
Of a sudden,
Wait, where
my
were
cousins
Alaska?
Were getting married.
Oh, okay.
And so, and my dad grew up there. Anyway, So I get this phone call, and I'm in Alaska with my family, and my mom is fed up with, like, events in Honduras. She's kind of, I have this thing with my mom called selective storytelling. Like, she doesn't know a lot about a lot of things that happen, like any drive-bys or muggings or anything like that. My mom just kind of doesn't need to hear about it. So anyway, I'm sitting at this table at some, like, diner in Alaska with, like, all my extended family and my mom and dad. And I get this call from Honduras. And so all of a sudden, like, this, my friend is on the phone, and she's like, you have to look at the news, like, Zelaya's in Costa Rica, and, like, all this stuff. And so all of a sudden, like, I have to leave the table, and everyone can see that I'm getting worried, because I'm thinking about my kids and my family, and, like, how all of them are being treated, because being on the poorer side of the spectrum, or the poor side of the spectrum, they kind of get last straw, so, or the short straw every time. So I'm getting nervous, and my family sees that I'm getting nervous. Anyway, I fly in the next day. My mom kind of put her foot down and was like, you're not going back. And I kind of put my foot down and said, see you later, Mom. And so I flew back to Honduras, and I got into San Pedro, which is like 45 minutes away from where I lived. And luckily, my friend came and picked me up, and she has family in San Pedro. And so we get halfway to Progreso, and you have to cross this big bridge, and it's taken over. So we pull up to the bridge, and it's like my first, you know, moments back in Honduras, and there's, like, burning tires and, like, people on this bridge into my town, you know? So, like, that's what it looked like at first. So it was like, oh my God, this is really real all of a sudden.
Like, military people on the bridge?
No, that was actually protesters, because it was a complicated coup for many reasons, but they were protesting the golpe, which is what you say in Spanish, so, like, the big hit. El golpe de Estado, like, the hit to the state or whatever.
Okay.
And so they were protesting that and saying that they didn't want their military to kick out Zelaya. And so anyway, these were just kind of normal people from my little town. So then I had to spend 2 days in San Pedro, where, like, it's the second, like, it's like the business capital of Honduras. And so it has this huge center. So all of a sudden it's like me and my flip-flops and, like, my chancletas, as they're called in Honduras. And so, like, I would just, like, go out, and, like, the parks, there were protesters, like, people yelling, like, I frequented this one little bookstore that was kind of this hole-in-the-wall bookstore, and because it had a lot of Honduran literature in Spanish and things, and I became really close with this, like, I don't know, 75-year-old guy who was just wildly intelligent, and you could talk about things for hours and hours. And all of a sudden, like, I'm walking in the park, and it's crazy, and, like, police are everywhere, and the military starting to surround the park or whatever. And my little bookstore man is, like, up on the front steps of the cathedral, because people hated the church at that time, because the bishop had sided with the golpe. Anyway, so, like, this man who I know is this really docile, intelligent, academic man is screaming from the cathedral steps into, like, a loudspeaker, and I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, so anyway, that's what a coup looks like, I guess. You know,
he's a little bookstore owner screaming,
yeah,
from the steps of a church.
That's what a coup is.
Yeah. Oh, Barracuda, come on.
But, you know, as the days went by in San Pedro, there was, like, tires burning on every corner and things like that, and that kind of settled down, and I think that people just became, and I don't know that it's this way, and I don't think it's this way in every coup, but people became kind of submissive, especially after there was a lot of human rights violations. Women were being raped. Like, I was lucky enough, lucky enough not to be in any of those situations, but two, I was fortunate enough to sit in with a group of women who my friend was at the local radio station, which was kind of the voice of the Honduran, of the pueblo at the time, right? Mm-hmm. And so they had a forum where they had women who had been violated by the police and all this stuff, and so it was this really trying day, you know, but mm-hmm. I was able to sit in on that and understand that, you know, I mean, there's real consequences. So during the coup, we had the state enforced curfews where you had to be in your house from, like, the first few days it was like 24-hour curfews, which got really crazy because people live day to day, you know, so yeah. Like, you eat what you make that day, you know, mm-hmm. So people started, I mean, they stormed our local grocery store and, like, it was crazy, but as the coup went on, it kind of settled down. And so I think a few months after the coup, curfew was still pretty tightly enforced, but it was only from 10 o'clock at night to 4 o'clock in the morning. And I had broken curfew maybe one or two times to go and, like, get eggs or whatever I could for dinner or whatever. So we had a curfew from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the morning, 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. And so I went over, and it was one of my, in San Pedro, there's kind of this, like, gay community that I was, you know, fortunate enough to become or get in contact with, because it's kind of an exclusive, I mean, mm-hmm. culturally, rightfully so, because it's really dangerous. But it's this really great little community. And so I was with these, one of my good girlfriends, and then these seven gay guys who were just fabulous. And they wanted to go to one of the three gay bars, but obviously we have curfew from 10 to 4, and it was one of their birthdays. And so, you know, we were at his party, and we were at his house just having a party. And he decided that he wanted to go dancing, like hell or high water, we are going dancing. And so I'm like, no, like I cannot do this. Like I'm not about to break curfew. Like I work for a nonprofit that has enough connection. Like if something happens and I'm in jail, well, I'll be able to get out. But like that's bad press, you know? Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I'm like, no, until about 9:45. And then I get in the car with them and we all go to the gay club, right?
A barracuda, come on. Look what she done to my arm. A ribbon red for your hair. A river from here to there. But when you're swimming away, I'm looking back.
And so we're all there like dancing and I think it was like 1:30 or so, like I was just exhausted. And so I go and like there's these really great like vinyl white leathery type couches. And so I'm like sitting on it and I'm like resting. And then all of a sudden I just hear a door splintering, and it's like six guys, six big policemen. And when they have all their gear on and like riot gear, they're, I mean, intimidating. So they come in with these big guns, and I don't know enough about guns, so I'm going to call them M16s with like flashlights on okay. them. I mean, they're big and they're semi-automatic to some extent. And so all of a sudden they like break in the door and like everyone just starts screaming. You just hear screaming, and then like they start separating everyone. They're pointing guns and they like kicked over couches and weird stuff. And then they separate. So they put boys on one side and the girls on the other side. And all the boys are like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And all the girls are like, what the fuck? Like, it was like super stereotypical. So like, there's like a handful of girls and like all these guys, but all the girls yeah. are just pissed on one side. Right. And so then they start like taking out all my friends. And just like all the guys that are kind of in line on the other side, and we're just watching. And I was like, oh, maybe they're letting everyone go. Well, it gets back to us that there's seven paddy wagons outside, mm-hmm. And Channel 6 News. And so I was like, oh my gosh, like I'm, you know, like part of this nonprofit, and I don't even go out in Progreso because I don't want to run into parents. You know, like I'm very, yeah. trying to be very respectful. But if I'm on the news getting busted for breaking curfew at a gay club, like, that's going to be a problem. Yeah. So, I grab my friend who I'm with, and I'm like, we got to get out of here. So we bust out the emergency exit, which, you know, for some reason they don't have guarded, and we get out to the roof and realize why, because it's a very Honduran exit, being that it's just a roof with no way off of it and a lot of trash. Like, you get out there and you're just like, oh, I'm stuck. So, all these people start piling out onto the emergency exit after us. And then my friend Luis ends up with us. So it's me and Meli and Luis and like all these people. And Meli or Luis is like, no, I'm going to hide. And so he gets into this like trashy tube. So he's like hiding and like kind of like, I don't know, just like really jammed into this tube. And then Meli's like, I'm like, dude, I'm not going to hide from the cops. If there's one thing I don't do, like it's hide from the police. I just think that's silly. 5 minutes later, I'm like on my stomach underneath this piece of plywood. Right. And so Meli's next to me and she's got her legs all bunched up under her, and like, I'm on my stomach, like looking out, and there's like a sliver right in front of my face where I can see like, you know, the steel toed boots walking by, and they escort everyone back in, 'cause there's kind of this herd of people in the corner.
Yeah.
So they're like, we told you all to stay inside. And so they get them back inside. Then they come out another time and another time. I kind of start giggling because I'm so nervous. And so Melly's getting mad at me under this piece of plywood. So we're kind of, you know, fighting or whatever. But they keep coming and they keep leaving. And then I calm myself down and I'm like, okay, this is going to be fine. And then, like, bam, like, his boot just, like, takes off the plywood. And he, like I don't know what kind of gun it was again. There was some kind of cocking motion going on.
Okay.
Where I was like, I'm gonna die, like, right now. And so I just, like, put my hands in the air, and I was like, you're right, I'm an idiot, you're so right, like, arrest me, I'm an idiot, you know? Like, I'm saying anything to just kind of, like, appease this man that has a gun on me. And then Melly's legs have fallen asleep, right? And so I have to, like, and so he thinks she's drunk, which is, you know, like, another layer of no-nos and whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm, like, trying to pick Meli up, and I'm like, dude, her legs just fell asleep, like, please put the gun down, we're going back inside, and, like, yeah. whatever. And they, like, kick the tube as all this chaos is going on, and, like, Luis comes, like, spilling out on it, you know, and...
I'm looking back on the day.
then we're waiting around inside, and I see one of my scholarship students, which is terrible, because he's not out, obviously, and it's Honduras, you know, and he's not out in Progreso. So he sees me, like, looking at him, because I wasn't quite sure at first, and then I was like, oh my god, that's one of my kids, you know? Mm-hmm. And so then he like, hides from me, basically. But now I'm looking at his group of friends, and, like, you can tell someone's moving and grooving on his cell phone, like he's just got connections, and like he knows when he gets to his end game, he's gonna get all his friends out of this mess. So I was like, we gotta get in that group. So I grab Meli and Luis, and like we go over into this group, and my scholarship student is like trying as hard as he can, like with these seven people, to stay as far away as he can from me. And so we walk out the door with this guy. Like, he goes right, he just blows by the police, like blows by the cameras, like my face is down, and then we get to, and we're talking like, what I'm assuming is, you know, like, La Mera Mera, like, the top police dog outside. And so he's, like, this kid is, like, no, like, my uncle, da-da-da-da-da. And the police kind of buys into it. And he's, like, well, all these people are your friends, right? And he was, like, yeah, all of them are my friends. All of them are my friends. And so he's, like, okay, call them by name. And so he starts calling him. And I was, like, shoot, I don't know this kid at all. And then I look over at my scholarship student, who's just grinning from ear to ear, right? Like, he's got all the power here, because he just doesn't, you know, he's obviously going to call my name. But he's just, like, has the power seat, and, like, takes, like, a good 7 seconds to call my name. And it was, like, the longest time of my life. But anyway, he's, like, Cat. And then I'm, like, okay, Meli Luis, like, come on. And then the police is, like, you guys have 6 seconds to get out of here. If any of you are here, like, after that time, we're just taking you in, like, on the spot, you know? And so then we just start booking. It's chaos. Everyone just, like, starts running, right? So we're running to our car, and I look up in a tree, like, as we're running, and my friend Ardalon, who's in a bright pink polo short sleeve shirt and bright white capri pants, is in a tree, and so he's, like, hugging this branch, and he keeps, like, motioning over, so, like, putting his finger to his lips and being like, shh, shh, you know, like, nobody's gonna see him. He's like a flamingo in a blizzard, you know, like, everyone can see this kid, right? So we, like, book it back to the house, and we get home safely. Thank goodness we didn't get stopped on the road. And then at 4:30 in the morning, we start rounding up our friends. Like, 5 of my friends were arrested and had to pay, like, all these fines, and then, well, bribes, basically. They don't get charged. You just have to pay off the police. And then we go back, and Ardalon had slept in that tree. Like, nobody had bothered to get him on that tree. So we get there, and he's, like, trying to, like, unpeel himself. And, yeah, but luckily I didn't get arrested for breaking curfew in a gay club that night.
Is that one of those stories that falls in the category of not telling your mom about?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure my mom doesn't know that one.
Okay.
Well, she might now. But, no, she doesn't know that one. Yeah, there are a few like that where selective storytelling, my friend.
I can't believe I haven't heard that before. This has been the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour. I've been Brian Bieber. Big thank you to Tanya Grogan for taking the time to come on the show. Not only is she a really nice and interesting lady, she's also the mother of one of my grade school classmates, which I didn't realize until right before the interview. So, small world, or small city we live in, at least. Thanks also to Heather Mangan. Believe it or not, there's even more to her story, so we're going to hear a little bit more from her later in the month in episode 2.5. A big thank you also to Kat Burdine. You can look for more stories from Kat in future episodes. She has a lot of them, and I have no reservations about exploiting her life experiences to generate material for the show. So you can look forward to more from Kat. You heard music in this episode from Nanuchka, Drug Cabin, and Artifact Shore. You can find links to all of those bands on ghostsandhorses.com. You also heard interstitial music by DJ Absolute of Soul Crate Music. The Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour theme is made up of Tiny Lights by We All Have Hooks for Hands off of their album The Shape of Energy. You can go to afternoonrecords.com and get their new record for free, which is like the best possible deal. So you won't get a better deal than that. The Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour logo is by Christy Corver. If you haven't already, subscribe in iTunes, and if you like the show, write a review, a positive review. I'm not soliciting any negative reviews at this point. I don't anticipate that I ever will. But if you like the show, please stop by iTunes and say so. For more information about our guests, you can go to ghostsandhorses.com. You can also download past episodes or listen directly there. And you can contact me directly at ghostsandhorses@gmail.com. This has been the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour. Thanks for listening.
No, you are. It sounds like I'm really rambling.
No,
it feels like I'm rambling.
Well, all the rambling gets cut out.